This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. The discussion of race and ethnicity in the American media has been the subject of study and debate for decades. One of those leading a charge toward a different conversation was Dorie Maynard, president of the Robert C. Maynard Institute for Journalism Education. She was a pioneering figure in pushing the media to better reflect America, to consider diversity as it tells stories, and diversity among those who tell the stories to the public. Maynard died earlier this year. In a remembrance on NPR, we heard her tell a story about how a seemingly simple change in perspective can provide a better insight into people's lives.
We sent some people once to a neighborhood that had a lot of immigrants in it, and we asked the reporters to ask community members, how can people better cover you? And the community members said, well, you can stop looking at us from your middle class point of view and stop calling us poor. You see two families living in one house and sharing a car. And so you think that's poor. And we say, we have a house, we have a car, we're not poor.
Economic disparity, race, gender, religion, sexual identity, citizenship status. The issues can be very hard to talk about, but they seem more important than ever. That's why NPR launched a network-wide diversity project in 2012. Today, Where We Live will be joined by two leaders of NPR's project to look more closely at how the media covers diversity and how we talk about it in society. A bit later, we'll also hear from a scholar and radio producer whose criticism of the whiteness of public radio has gained a lot of attention on Twitter. We'll talk about code switching and how the voice can be used to tell the same story in different ways. As always, we invite you to share your thoughts. How well do you think diversity is being represented in the media? How do you think we're doing? What could we be doing better? Join the conversation. Comment on our website, WNPR.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us in studio is Keith Woods. He's NPR's Vice President for Diversity in News and Operations. Keith Woods, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And Luis Clemens is here. He's NPR's Senior Editor for Diversity. Luis, thank you for coming.
It's good to be here.
And I should tell our listeners that you're both here visiting because you travel to public radio stations and you talk about these issues. Before we get into some of the actual issues, talk about that part of it, about why you take this on the road and go to public radio stations.
Well, when I came to NPR in 2010, the CEO then, Vivian Schiller, asked me to add to the portfolio of work that we were doing, a lot of which is, most of which is at NPR, add to that a system-wide conversation. Because when you listen to NPR, a public radio anywhere, you are listening to all of us. You are listening to WNPR, to Connecticut Public Media, at the same time that you're hearing Morning Edition and All Things Considered coming from NPR. So we are in this together as a network. It makes every bit of sense for us to be having one conversation across the network.
When you listen to media across this network, before we get to the media at large and those outside of NPR, what do you hear? Do you hear a media that is embracing some of these ideas, that actually tries to sound like America, to use diverse voices?
I think it is such a mixed bag. You know, 270-odd public radio stations across the country. The answer's all over the map, just as the stations are. There are places where you can hear the effort very specifically because the stations are reaching out to as much of the community as possible. And then there are places where you can hear the holes in the coverage and people can fairly easily identify where they are, where those holes are when you go to the station. And I was just in Miami earlier this week, and they joked there that they would have to try really hard to leave Latinos out of the coverage in a place like Miami. But when you talk about other Latinos who are not from Cuba, they find some of the holes. When you talk about black people in Miami, you could be talking about African Americans or Haitians or other folks from the Caribbean. Sometimes you hear all of their voices, sometimes you don't. So it really is, across the country, a combination of the audience and the efforts of the station.
Does this in some ways, Luis, reflect the actual attitudes of the communities that the public radio stations are trying to serve? In that, do we as public broadcasters tend to leave out the same voices that tend to have less voice in the public forum, in politics, and everywhere else? Or is there something else that you're hearing as an editor?
You know, I think there are two things at play. I mean, I grew up in Miami. And I was 40 years old before I ever listened to a public radio program, and that was the night before I was scheduled to be interviewed. And I'd been a journalist at that point for almost 20 years. So, growing up in Miami, radio was Spanish language talk radio. It was not public radio. It was not English language discussion of news and public affairs. So part of what's going on here is that we haven't done a very good job of reaching out to the entirety of the public. I think when we're talking about the stories that we cover, too often, and this is something that we'll talk about over the next couple of days, we interview people who are like us. We seek out stories from people who are like us, who are neighbors, who are, fellow members of the PTA, fellow members of a congregation, what have you. You really have to push yourself to reach out across your own personal boundaries and speak to people you wouldn't normally speak to. Actively seek out stories that you might not be inclined to do so. And that's an effort that has to happen really at every station and across the network.
But that sounds like something different in terms of getting reporters to think differently than just thinking about diversity, perhaps as we define it. That's about pushing yourself to talk to those who you're not familiar with. And those could be other people of your race, but certainly of a different class situation, a different socioeconomic situation, a different religious situation. That's a boundary we often don't cross.
That's right. Or someone who doesn't believe in a given faith at all. So I would say, actually, that when we're talking about diversity, we're talking about economic, we're talking about class, we're talking about geographic, we're talking about what neighborhoods do you cover, what parts of the city or the state do you cover, don't cover, and you're talking race and ethnicity. We really should approach it sort of broadly across all those different categories.
Hey, Keith, maybe pick up on that a little bit and talk more about what diversity really means to you in this project that NPR is doing that you've undertaken over the course of the last couple of years. Because it's easy when people use the word diversity to have it be a stand-in for talking about race. Because as I said at the top, people think it's hard to talk about all the stuff, and we're going to try to get to some of the difficult issues. But what do you mean by diversity when you talk about it?
Well, that's funny because again, we're going to have this conversation in a little while here. I think that the issue is let me divide it up for you. What we're doing right now in this very specific effort at sourcing is aimed at bringing people into our content in three areas very specifically under the larger umbrella of diversity. One is geographic, so that when we talk about sounding like America, we have America's accents and regionality in our content. Another is gender, so that when we're talking to experts, women are as likely to be heard on our air as men. And race and ethnicity, and that cuts across the full range of difference in the country by race and ethnicity. That is something very specific that we launched a few years ago. When we talk about diversity at NPR beyond that, we're talking about everything from region to sexuality to class and gender and all of the other categories of diversity that we talk about. And we're not just talking about the existence of that in our content. We're talking about the people we're employing. We're talking about the audiences that we are seeking to connect with. So if you think about it only as hearing a black voice on the air, you've narrowed the field too greatly, but we are also talking about that.
We're talking today with Keith Woods and Louise Clemens. They're part of the diversity project at NPR that has come to our station over the course of the next few days to talk about this with our journalists and the issues of diversity in the news media. We'd like to hear what you think about how we're doing. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Keith, how much of it is that public radio newsrooms and also just newsrooms in general don't reflect the same sort of diversity that you're talking about? That indeed we have, a certain sort of person working in newspapers, working in radio stations, and that's why we sound like we do?
Well, I think it is a part. For certain, and it's hard to tell you whether that is 50% of the problem or 80% of the problem, but it is a part of it, and it is human nature acting on us all the time, from being attracted to stories that are in some way reflective of our lives, or reacting to job candidates who somehow feel familiar and fit, one of the words that we use in hiring to describe that. it's a little bit of all of those things. One of the things that we found in our research is that you can correlate the gender of the journalist and the gender of their sources, that you can correlate the race and ethnicity of the journalist and the race and ethnicity of their sources. So there is a relationship there that tells you that it is important to really pursue greater diversity within your hiring. But one of the things that you will find always is that if, for example, you employ a black man, and I'm a black man, and I go out to do journalism, I'm fairly certain to have a greater number of black sources in my content. Latinos will not show up any better in my content, according to our research, as they would in a white person's, a non-Latino white person's content. And so you don't solve the problem simply by creating this greater diversity on your staff. You help it. The greatest solution has to come from everybody's ability to recognize that who you are is influencing everything that you're doing every day, ideologically, by class, by geography, by culture, by all of those things that we bring to the table.
The clip that we heard from the obit, Luis, actually points to something that I think is important. Sourcing is really an important part of this because we want to make sure that the sources that we use in the news reflect this diversity. But the way in which we approach a story and even the language that we use with people is almost just as important. We may reach out to people who are of a certain socioeconomic status, but then the way we talk about them, whether or not they're poor or disadvantaged, we use words like urban all the time as a stand-in for I don't know what. How much of that is the problem, the fact that we don't have the language right around this, even when we're talking with the right people?
Well, you kind of can't separate the two, right? People don't like being talked about as if they were some kind of academic specimen. We're journalists. We're not anthropologists. There shouldn't be that kind of distance between us and the people we write about. We should be engaging them and speaking using the clearest possible language that is universally understood. But I would say it starts, if we're going to say there's a chicken and an egg, I would point to reaching out to a broader range of sources. I would start with reaching out to those new voices and making sure that they're getting heard, and realizing that they're not new. They're only new to us and perhaps new to our audience.
Do you worry sometimes as someone from Miami, and we brought up, say, the Cuban community in Miami, there are a number of shorthands that we may use for what a certain community is like. We understand that the Cuban community is more politically conservative than in other parts of the country. And whether or not you're an editor in Washington or New York or in Hartford, Connecticut, those are some of the biases that you take as well with you to tell your stories. And so when you're reaching out to people, you often say, okay, well, I know that in this neighborhood there's a big Brazilian population, so let's go there to get that particular voice. Can you talk about overcoming that from a news gathering standpoint? Because it's not just that we tend to go to people who are like us, but we also tend to go to the easy thing that we know a shorthand of, the thing that's at the top of our mind.
Sure. So, I mean, in Miami, there is a restaurant, a famous restaurant in Little Havana called Versailles. And it's a place where politicians go to shake hands, and it's the place where many journalists go to seek out conservative anti-Castro viewpoints. And the antidote here is facts. Guess what? More Cubans voted for Obama than didn't. And that's for two elections running. So that shift in the Cuban population in Miami is a reality, and you can refer to it by surveys, you can refer to it by data. If you're grounded in the facts rather than the assumptions and the thoughts of what you think people represent, you're grounded in reality at that point. I think you have to constantly check what your assumptions are. I mean, look, when I do an edit of a story, line by line, the final piece of it is, how do we know this to be true? And if the answer is, well, everyone knows that, well, that's not always the case. I mean, edited a piece, silly story about Thanksgiving travel, all right? And silly being not of major consequence. We had a line in the piece there saying it's the busiest travel day of the year. Guess what? It's not. I mean, it's we thought it was true. We assumed it was true. It's not. There are several days each summer that usually have much more traffic, air traffic, than Thanksgiving Day. So our assumptions are generally not worth much. They really have to be backed up by facts.
And assumptions like that can be certainly wrong, but not as damaging as when you're using assumptions to create a stereotype that then perpetuates something that can be quite dangerous.
But it's still insidious in a way, no? The fact that we assume something to be true that is not.
We're talking with Louise Clemens and Keith Woods. They're both from NPR. They're visiting today as part of a diversity training program that they do with public radio stations nationwide. I asked them in here to talk about some of these issues around race and ethnicity and class, all of these things that we have to grapple with in the news every single day. We'll dig into some of the stories that have been in the news over the course of this last year and see how diversity in the media plays into them. We'll be right back where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today in the program, we're welcoming in Keith Woods, who's NPR's Vice President for Diversity in News and Operations, and Louise Clemens, who is NPR's Senior Editor for Diversity. They're here as part of a diversity training program that they do with public radio stations nationwide, and they're here in Connecticut for a few days meeting with us as we talk about diversity in the media, and we'll get to some of your calls in just a moment. I want to ask about two specific stories that have been obviously very important over the course of the last year. One has to do with everything that happened around Ferguson, Missouri, and Staten Island, New York. The way in which we as a society kind of grappled with these issues in the media, on CNN all day long, certainly on public radio stations as well. Keith, I'll ask you first, listening back and thinking back about the way the media handled and covered these very important issues in America, what did you think? How did we do?
Well, it really, again, it depends on which piece of it we're talking about. I think that when you're covering a major story that combines police, so issues around public safety and race, we often are guilty of conflating those two and speaking about the issue of race as though it is resolved in some way in the criminal justice system, or the other way around, thinking that issues of criminal justice are themselves always issues of race. I think that where we have succeeded, where we've done the best work in that kind of coverage, it's been when we've been able to pull those things apart and talk about them as intelligently as possible separately. So in the case of Ferguson, for example, you had a very specific police case. A young man is shot in the street. The community responds to that, and you wind up with all of the both social and literal conflagrations that happened there. Well, here's the thing: you can talk about the very specific details of what happened in Ferguson, the police officer, his actions, the young man's actions before and after he was killed. And you can talk about those things separate from the question of race. But when you enter into the conversation about race, there is a contextualizing that has to happen that I don't think happens often enough and didn't happen in many cases in both Ferguson and in Staten Island, in which you understand why people are upset when a police officer, and often a white police officer, but not always, is involved in a shooting with a young black man. If you take it out of the context of all of the times this has happened in history, and you have to go back, all the way back, to talk about that, then the behavior of the people in the community, the people who were protesting, not the ones who were looting, That becomes odd to people. They don't understand why the level of anger got to where it got to so quickly, or why the level of distrust is what it is. And if you don't have that conversation, you're really not helping the public to understand the story that you're telling them.
Well, one thing that Luis brought up earlier is this idea that obviously if we're armed with the facts and we know the data and we can say something more specific about how often young black men are pulled over, how often young black men are shot by cops, et cetera, that it will help us tell the story. One thing, though, Luis, that maybe needs to be part of that equation is that no matter what the facts are, the people on the ground feel a certain way.
Absolutely.
Even if the numbers don't back up a contention that there's more police stops in this town of young black men by the police, if the people in that community feel it, then that becomes part of the story. So talk about that in terms of the contextualization of the storytelling, because I think that's one of the things we were grappling with there. We're grappling with real facts on the ground. We were grappling in Ferguson, certainly, with some facts we didn't know specifics about. And then there was an awful lot of feelings in that community that I think the rest of us outside of Ferguson just couldn't have understood.
You know, I don't know if there's a barrier to understanding if you're not from Ferguson, if you find yourself in a similarly placed city in a similarly placed situation. You know, let's go back to the facts, though. Wade Goodwin, one of our correspondents, says, you know, stick close to the facts. It's nice and warm there. When we talk about the facts, let's talk about what we don't have. We don't have facts, as mentioned by the director of the FBI in a recent speech about race. We don't have facts of how many police officers kill, how many people are shot and killed by police officers each year. We don't know how that breaks down by race. But what we do know about Ferguson in particular is that there are a series of penalties that are imposed if you are arrested that have to be financed by the person that is arrested that ends up to very lengthy prison sentences, not prison sentences, jail stays for people who cannot pay for their own jail fees. And that's something that comes out of reporting. That's something that Joe Shapiro, one of our correspondents, reported on, and you're talking about sticking close to the facts. Now, you have to talk about those feelings. That's very much a part of it. And when Cheryl Corley goes and spends a week in Ferguson, she spends time talking to a lot of people, trying to get a sense of what motivates people's feelings. And sometimes just the simple act of sticking a mic in someone's face and asking the question. With radio, you get this intimacy of hearing the response and being able to, if not place yourself in someone else's position, at least be in a reasonable frame of mind when you hear it and be open to the possibility of understanding what they are saying.
And do you think that that's one reason why radio, Keith, might help us tell these stories better? Because you really are, in almost all cases, on the record, speaking with your own voice and emoting and in telling people a story in a way that maybe doesn't show up in print the same way.
Very much so, but which, you know, go back to our earlier conversation, you have to be there. You have to have those conversations in which people get to know you as a journalist or as a news organization well enough to offer up that level of intimacy and that level of honesty and candor in the conversation. Because, it, you know, in the end, when you look at what we're trying to get at in the coverage of Ferguson or Staten Island or any of the other stories like this around the country, we're trying to help people to connect the dots between things that don't necessarily strike us as being related. We talk about feelings at the end of a string of connected dots. We didn't just arrive at the way that we feel. Things happened that contributed to it. And when you look at the police stopped, and as our code switch correspondent Gene Demby pointed out, it is the accretion of things. It is when you are stopped often that you're late for work, that you lose jobs or lose opportunities, your life is disrupted constantly. You may not get shot. You may not get brutalized. The things that we talk about in the end that happened to Michael Brown don't necessarily happen to everybody. But the consequence of it to you, to your sons and daughters, to your wives and husbands to the people who are part of your life becomes the combination of things that lead to that feeling at the end of it. And unless you can understand those things, then these people just seem to be acting weird.
I mean, there is weight to events. And consider a police stop, consider a police cruiser going by, consider the exchange of stares. All those things, they add up. When Keith talks about accretion, you know, it's the adding up of little things that help drive emotions. And if you're not in a position to detail what those events are and how they happen, then the feelings can seem like they come out of nowhere.
But it's also why, aside from sourcing, aside from sticking to the facts, just that basic human trait of empathy for yeah. people reporting this is so very important. I mean, I can just say, and I've said this on the air when we've done forums all throughout the course of this year around these issues, is I just literally cannot know what it's like to be a black man who is stopped regularly for no particular reason. I'd like to try to put myself in his shoes, but I can't. And so without that, I need to figure out some way to at least inhabit that mindset. And that, Keith, before we get to some phone calls, I say that must be a hard thing to teach people, to teach a middle-aged white journalist who doesn't have that experiences to do.
Well, what you're trying to help people to do isn't to sort of don the clothes of other people. What you're trying to do is get people to have an expectation, to walk in with an expectation that, number one, they don't know it all already. So humility being a huge piece of the toolbox, of tool in the toolbox, but also walk in with the assumption of the existence of things you cannot see going in, so that curiosity drives you to ask questions and listen harder for the things that will be unfamiliar. We have the hardest time as human beings hearing the unfamiliar. I may have just said it, and you may not have heard it because it just wasn't familiar enough to you, and we have to learn the skill of opening up. That will get us a great distance long before we begin to understand or fully feel the things that other people feel. We just have to make it possible for them to express it.
We're talking about media and diversity today with Keith Woods and Louise Clemens from NPR, who are visiting our station here in Hartford at WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live. Mary is calling from Hartford. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
The news, you know, it seems to focus on divisive stories, especially policing when it comes to diversity. And I think that there's a lot of pressing issues, especially the environment or climate change, where we need diverse perspectives, race, income, where you're from, and that we might learn that we share a lot and could help each other a lot instead of seeing the differences in the news.
Mary, thank you very much for the phone call. I quickly want to go to Lourdes, who's calling from Rye, New York. Hi, Lourdes.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, I'm a Cuban-American, born and raised in Miami, went to the University of Miami, and moved to New York in my late 20s. How much do you think the media is responsible for certain perceptions? For example, being Cuban-American, I get in New York a lot, oh, you're so fair for being Cuban, or, oh, you don't sound Cuban, you don't look Cuban. How much do you think the media is responsible for those perceptions?
It's a great question, Lourdes.
Lourdes, to my fellow Cubana from Miami, I have received very similar questions. I don't know at what point the media in general, and that's a very broad term that incorporates a whole lot of things, should be blamed for, you know, perception of Cuban Americans in terms of what we look like or sound like. I think part of that is just a general unfamiliarity with Cubans in particular. I mean, look, we concentrate ourselves largely in South Florida. So unlike Mexican Americans who are present really across the country, we're an unknown quantity. So how much is that is media? I don't know. But I'll say this. I would definitely say media coverage pointing to, oh, all Cubans are, you know, rabid anti-Castro and, they always vote Republican, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That I'm happy to pinpoint the blame on media collectively.
Thank you very much for the phone call. Let's go to Delcy, who is calling from Milford. Hi, Delcy. You're on with Louise Clemens and Keith Woods.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I find that using the language you speak or the color of your skin very limited in describing an individual. You can be African-American and you can be from South America, Africa, or Kansas City. Your acculturation is going to be very different. Your perspective will be very different. And I think we have to go beyond the looking and go down to those many different layers. The other piece is the incident in Ferguson. It was terrible. A young man lost his life and in Staten Island. But we don't know all the other stats. We don't know how many Caucasians or Latinos, and I don't know, I don't even, I find these categories very troubling, I should tell you that, are killed by white policemen or black policemen or Spanish-speaking policemen or Asian policemen.
Well,
we have to know all those numbers before we can draw some of the conclusions we've drawn.
And Delcy, thank you very much. And I think that's, Keith, that's what Luis was getting at. I mean, the more we can know those numbers, the more we can tell a full story. I think, though, something else that Delcy's saying is something that I hear an awful lot from my listeners whenever we talk about issues of race, is that a lot of people say, look, we shouldn't be categorizing people. We shouldn't be talking about blacks and whites and Latinos. We really need to be talking about people as people. And that if we were doing that more, then we'd all get along better in a lot of different ways. I'm sure that's something that you hear an awful lot when you do this training, when you talk to people. How do you respond to that?
Well, look, I think we all aspire to a place and time, you know, the color, the content of my character versus the color of my skin days. But we will get there first by going through these issues directly, not by sort of essentially assuming their absence and then hoping that the society comports to that assumption. I think what we aspire to is a way of being different and honoring the differences that we have, while also minimizing, or even if it's ever possible, eliminating the consequence of difference as it relates to something like policing or hiring or education or any of the other universes that we live in. So I'm fully in favor of the vision of transcending race and gender and class and sexual orientation and all of the other things, but only after we've done the hard work of tackling that, and I think that we are still a distance away from that. I want to just speak to two other things.
Sure, please.
One is that as human beings have to work on our own conclusions that we're drawing based on something like race or ethnicity or sexual orientation or any of those things, and the things we automatically assume to be so once we see someone like that. That's our individual work. And again, I agree that where we go wrong, especially in the media, is when we say something like white people in Iowa voted for Barack Obama in the 2008 campaign, and that therefore means some transcendence of race for the white voters in Iowa. Black voters in South Carolina voted overwhelmingly for Barack Obama, and that is an indication that they are voting based on race. Mm-hmm. That's it. You will hear that, and you will hear it again in this campaign, absolutely, once again, when we start looking at these races where you have race or gender as an issue, that there will be an assumption that women are voting for Hillary Clinton if she runs because she's a woman. And we have to unpack those kinds of things as much as possible.
When we come back from our break, we're going to bring somebody else into the conversation. He's a scholar and a radio producer who's challenged the idea of the whiteness of public radio, at least in the sound of the voice. It's something that kind of blew up on Twitter and had a lot of people in our business and outside our business talking about. So we'll be meeting him in a moment. We're joined by Keith Woods and Louise Clemens from NPR. We'll take some more of your phone calls as well as we talk about race and diversity and the media here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, join me for a conversation on race with Ta-Nehisi Coates. He's the national correspondent for The Atlantic. He was in Hartford being honored as the 2015 Stowe Prize winner for his work addressing social and civil justice issues. We'll be talking about those issues in a conversation at the Emmanuel Congregational Church as part of a program by the Harry Beecher Stowe Center in Hartford. I hope you can join us for this conversation coming up on Mondays, Where We Live. Today we're talking about race and ethnicity and diversity in the media with Keith Woods and Louise Clemens. They're both from NPR. There's an NPR diversity project that goes from station to station all across America talking to journalists about diversity issues, and they're here with us in Hartford for a few days, and we're happy to have them in the studio. We'll get to some more of your phone calls in a moment, but first I want to welcome into our conversation Chenjerai Kumanyika, who's an assistant professor at Clemson University's Communication Studies Department. He got a big conversation around some of these issues started first on the website transom.org. It later went to NPR and, well, was a bit of a viral hit on Twitter, and it challenged the whiteness of public radio, the sound that we tend to associate with public radio. Chenjerai, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What made you think to write this piece and to share some of these ideas with the American public?
Well, I was in the context of a transom.org workshop, and Transom does great work helping people to produce radio and developing, you know, amateur radio producers and actually skilled radio producers. And I was making a short piece about a fisherman. And as I was voicing and editing the piece, I suddenly realized that, like, you know, that I was hearing this other voice that wasn't my own, kind of hearing it in my head and sort of slowly orienting myself toward that voice rather than the way that I speak other times. And, you know, that was worrisome to me because I thought that I wasn't sure if I had sort of permission to just be myself. I mean, the producers kind of told me I did, but I didn't really have a lot of examples of that, and particularly in non-narrative fiction non-fiction narrative podcast. So that got me thinking about what diversity really means in this other layer of diversity that involves, like, here I was, right? I was a person of color in the room, but now I was in a way sort of, you know, squeezing the diversity out because of the way I was telling the story.
And we actually have a couple clips from this piece that was on transom.org. And let's listen to a few. First, you're a hip-hop artist, so we're going to hear a little bit of you using this voice in that context. Let's listen.
I can't breathe, hear my brother dying. Every day another name, another mother crying. Oh, Lord, now we shutting down your Walmart.
Okay, now the next voice you're going to hear is this piece about a fisherman that you were working on. And this is the public radio voice that I think we all know very well.
For John, losing a fish is no small thing, because John is a fisherman with a capital F.
So tell me about that. When you heard that, I mean, what were you thinking about? Were you thinking, like, I know what public radio sounds like, and so I'm trying to be a little bit more like that? Were you self-consciously trying to limit your vocal range? I mean, what was going through your mind?
I mean, you know, the elements of the story were going through my mind, but really I was just trying to be professional. I was trying to do a good job. I was trying to be clear. But, you know, what I realize is that this is why, I mean, and by the way, let me just say, I love the conversation that's been happening. I've been listening in and taking notes. But this is why I think we have to unpack the way that issues of race, ethnicity, gender, you know, geography hide in terms like professional and standard. Because I was just trying to be professional, right, and do a good job. But in that, I was orienting myself towards what a certain group of people might feel comfortable hearing.
But I can see how that extends far beyond how you might sound on the radio. This idea of what it's like to be professional in this context probably can extend to an awful lot of your life and might indeed limit the way in which you express yourself as a black man in America today.
No, that's absolutely right. And so one of the great things I've been learning in the wake of the response to the piece is just the different ways this affects different people. There's a great piece that came out yesterday by her name is, I believe, Mihi Court Kim. I'm probably butchering her name, but she's a Korean preacher. And she talked about being told that she was preaching wrong. And she said that her piece was in part inspired by my piece. So you're right. It does extend even beyond the world of media.
Luis, I want to ask you about this because I think this is a really important part of the NPR conversation. We've talked an awful lot about diversity in sourcing, but because radio is a medium in which you hear voices, mm-hmm. if you put an African-American man into a story and you want people to know that it's an African-American man for some reason editorially, does he have to sound a certain way to the ear? I mean, is that part of the storytelling convention that maybe we think about in kind of the wrong way? It's certainly something the Ginger Eyes piece has gotten me thinking a lot more about. Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess the first question is, you know, is it really necessary? I mean, do you have to identify this person as a black man? Is it directly relevant to the story? Well, if it is, then yes. But, you know, the number of times Michelle Norris talks about this, Audie Cornish talks about this, the surprise that people often experience when they meet them and they go, oh, you're black, because they didn't hear that. They didn't think that was the case. You know, we're often asked in these classes about, well, do I get credit, essentially is what many times people are asking, for interviewing a Latino who doesn't sound like a Latino? Well, what does a Latino sound like? Well, I interviewed someone who's Asian, but, you know, their name doesn't sound Asian. Is that still all right? Well, guess what? They know they're Asian. Their family knows they're Asian.
But Ginger, I think to your point, with that, when we don't hear that difference, maybe there is something missing from the context. I mean, give me your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I really, you know, and if you read the full piece on Transom, you'll see that I'm against essentializing voices in problematic ways, like just saying there's one white voice or there's one way to sound, or, you know, I don't know that that part is important. But I know that when I listen to the landscape of public radio, and Luis pointed out this is different depending on where you're listening, but when I listen to the radio that I've heard in Philadelphia and in certain parts of California, in Chicago, and down here in South Carolina, I'm not hearing a full range of the public that I know. And so I'm worried about the ways, even more so than just the host, because Audie Cornish pointed out it's not just about the host, about the sources. What kinds of voices are being sort of subconsciously ruled out? Like we just decide, well, people aren't going to understand this person. And really, they don't need to be pushed to invite themselves into that person's world.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what Chandra, I was just saying about the public. Look, we have a special responsibility, not only as journalists, but journalists working in public media, to incorporate the public in all its infinite variety. That is an obligation, and to the extent that this essay has clearly, you know, raised and increased the discussion about it, I thank you. I thank you, because it's not something that was being discussed as openly, being discussed as broadly, or in the same way, or incorporating as many people.
Well, one of the things that came up in the conversation, and again, Audie was one of the people who brought it up, is that, you know, there are the people who find themselves affecting their voice, mm-hmm, to sound different, and then as Audie, who says, "This is how I sound. Right. This is when you talk to me outside of the studio, I sound exactly the same way." That's the range, right? That's the humanity that we're dealing with. And what I would say to people who worry about not getting the credit because the voice didn't sound like the ethnicity that you were after, what I would say is keep interviewing, keep going, because if you are in fact out in the communities, out in the country, talking to people, you will find that range, and I will hear it, and I will hear the Latina who has a Hispanic sounding name, and I will recognize her as that. I'll hear the Latina who has an accent, and I'll hear that, and I'll hear the Latina who is indistinguishable from anybody else by name or accent, and they'll all be in my content. And when we get there, then we move a little bit further away from this.
Well, and I think, Ginger, one of the things that NPR has really brought up, even by naming their project Code Switch, is this idea that this happens in America and really across the world all the time, that people really do talk differently when they're in different groups of people, when they're in different social situations. And I'm sure that that's a piece of this, too. This isn't just about how you present yourself on the radio. This is probably how you and many other people present themselves in all sorts of contexts. I know I do the same thing myself.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's about having a more complicated conversation about what professional means. And I would say an ongoing conversation. It's not about trying to dispense with the idea of standards or professional or reaching as many people. But, you know, you learn a lot from the pushback, you know, too, in these conversations about the work that we have to do. You know, if you look at the comments on NPR's in response on their actual page, you see some very kind of, you know, a lot of assumptions about who, you know, who's uneducated, who's not. And then, yeah, it's just really, you learn a lot from hearing. There's a great article that came out a year ago by, I'm going to try to pronounce his name properly, Gustavo Arellano. And he talks about the way that sometimes people get annoyed when people of Latino descent pronounce their name with the full accent, mm-hmm. you know. And he kind of says, you know, to raise questions about that and say that this is not approached the same way among different Latino communities. But, you know, just the idea that someone would be offended because you pronounced your name with an accent and that people feel comfortable to say that in public, I think that shows that there's some work that has to be done.
Yeah, this is something that NPR has faced an awful lot. But many of the newscasters and the announcers have been criticized for years for that very same thing, Luis.
Well, you know, I think Mandalita el Barco.
Yes.
All right. And I would say she's not pronouncing her name with an accent. She's pronouncing her name. That is her
That's
name,
right.
Mandalita
so
del right. Barco.
But if you go across that range, I think again, we have to hear ourselves better. When we're in this conversation, because you know there is this range that already exists in public radio, and if you speak in much of media with a British accent, people don't say, "Hey, why are you pronouncing your name with a British accent?" I think part of it is that we don't see how we're separating things out ourselves when we're jumping into this conversation. You know what Chenjerai has pointed out, I think. Is something that is hard to name. It is hard to own in the country that the sound, the sort of original sound that we are using as our standard, came from somewhere. Mm-hmm. It came from some people, and it may be hard to put a race on it so cleanly, but it has roots in race, and it may not have roots in racism, which is why people I think have this visceral reaction to it. But it absolutely has its roots in race. And if we can't get to the place where we can see that, it's hard to see his point clearly.
Can I just jump in and say,
absolutely.
You know, Keith, I think earlier you made the great point about curiosity, because I think for so many people, when it comes to these issues of social justice, right, it's like, oh, now here's another layer of something we have to worry about. We're worrying about the bodies, we're worrying about the sources, we're worrying about the topics. Now we have to worry about the voice. But I look at it as, you know, curiosity in the sense of actually learning and pleasure that can come when I have to learn new things and understand that, yeah, the way someone is pronouncing it, that's the correct way. That's not an accent or what other things are encoded in that language that I'm going to hear that I might have to push my boundaries. So I think it's a real opportunity there.
Chenjerai Kumanyika is an assistant professor at Clemson University's Communication Studies Department, and he's a radio producer as well. And he joined us today from South Carolina. Chenjerai, thank you so much for joining this conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, and thank all of you for a great conversation.
I also want to thank Keith Woods, who's NPR's Vice President for Diversity in News and Operations, and Luis Clemens, who's NPR's Senior Editor for Diversity, for joining us in this conversation and also joining us for a few days here in Hartford to talk more about these issues with our staff. Thank you guys for coming in.
Hey, this has been great. Thank you.
Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Kyone Wolfe. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. The executive producer of our program is Katie Solarski. Our interns, Julia Pastel, Sydney Lauro, Anna Novak, and Kelsey Bissell. I'm John Dankosky. Continue this conversation at WNPR.org. This is where we live.